have just walked into Joe Tilson's house in Sloane Square, and we're about to go down some very narrow steps into his studio, which is in the basement. I'm surrounded by artwork by Joe Tilson, taped to the walls and balanced on bookcases. And down the steps, I'm met by a room full of books and artwork, things bubble wrap. This feels like very much a working studio.
I'm Charlotte Mullins, and this is Making a Mark, the podcast from the Christea Roberts Gallery about artists and their relationship to printmaking.
Turning around the corner, you see the garden and a studio full of light, and Joe Tilson sitting in a chair.
He's gearing up for his 94th birthday the following day.
Hello, Joe.
Hello.
Ever since his early screen prints that were at the heart of British pop art, Joe has been involved with printmaking, often experimenting with print processes that artists simply weren't meant to use.
Joe was radical in having such a wide range of solutions to the making of art, folding the sheet of paper, printing on both sides, vacuum forming it so that it's three-dimensional. So his career as a printmaker is very unusual and takes a very wide view of what constitutes an original print.
I mean, he was a carpenter, I believe, before anything else. And so his work is structural. It's slightly geometric. It's very often 3D. Whether it's large or whether it's small, it's kind of memorable and you want to touch it.
Oh, well, it's such an honour to be with you today, Joe, in your lovely studio in leafy West London. We are obviously here to talk about your incredible career and the way you've ripped up the rule book with printmaking, I think. So I wanted
Hopefully.
Yeah, well, I think you have. I wanted to start with something Alan Christea said. He said, for Joe Tilson, printmaking has infiltrated and informed every aspect of his creative output. Do you agree?
Yes. But only from when I started really seriously doing it in the late 50s. And then I attacked, yeah.
But when you did, you'd been to the Central St Martins and the Royal College of Art, and
And 3 years in Italy.
And 3 years in Italy. And yeah. You were at this sort of epicentre of what became known as British pop art.
That's true, yes.
I'm looking just behind you. There's a fabulous screen print from this period.
Yeah.
Is the Che Guevara from 1969. And there's a thin strip of Bolivia, a map of Bolivia hanging down. There are multiple pictures of Che Guevara.
And his girlfriend.
His girlfriend, but with actual paper clips holding it onto
prints. I've never really wanted to go along with the traditional thing where printers all agree on a certain thing and it all looks the same. So therefore, in screen printing, I've added the things you're not allowed to do, like objects on it, you know, scribbling on it, writing on it, adding things to it, collage, and taking the whole thing forward. Much, I hope, in a tradition like Picasso and Matisse and Goya, who equally took printmaking a big step forward.
He'd done national service, and then he went to the Royal College of Art, where he was surrounded mostly by younger artists, people like Alan Jones, David Hockney, Peter Phillips, all of whom were playing around at that time with pop imagery. Something fresh, something transatlantic, using subject matter that had never been used before, using collage extensively, all of which lent itself to screen printing. And so the first works I saw by Joe were very much pop art orientated. I'm Alan Christea, and I'm a director of the Christea Roberts Gallery in Pall Mall. And I've been working with Joe Tilson for over 50 years. One of the definitions of pop art was that it should be ephemeral. And so over the last 50 years, a lot of conservators have spent their time trying to restore works that were supposed to be transient in any case. And Joe, in a sense, depending on one's point of view, was the worst culprit in that sense, since if you gave him a rule, he would immediately try to break it. And he broke the rules very successfully.
Tilson's work was considered so radical that in 1963, the Printmakers' Council of Great Britain questioned its validity. The council had a problem with artists like Tilson calling their work prints because they used photomechanical reproduction rather than traditional engraving or lithography. So the Printmakers' Council demanded the Bridge Gallery take down Tilson's latest exhibition. Jo responded by writing a list of everything one wasn't supposed to do when making a print and then successfully incorporating every single one of those elements into his printmaking.
Make each print different. Paint on prints. Draw on prints. Tear the paper. Crumple and fold the paper. Print on the margins. Print on canvas and then paint.
So these are all things you're not supposed to, you thought the Printmaking Council thought you were not supposed to do on a print.
Absolutely, the printmaker.
What I love at the bottom of this almost a manifesto about print you wrote, yeah. You have written at the bottom, my work since then has used all these ideas.
It certainly has, yeah.
Did printmaking offer you a way of, did it allow you to experiment? Was that why you were drawn to it? Or was it just the right medium at the right time?
No, I think I sound bad-tempered and bullshy, and I just made art the way I wanted to make it, and it's always just been what I wanted, not what they or other people want.
You didn't want to be pinned in by definitions?
No. I started work at the age of 14 and worked for years making tables, and then ended up doing 3 years in the Air Force where I was drilled. But that, in a way, is... inform my life, having been forced into those awful obeying people. I've decided after that, when I left the Air Force, never to obey anybody ever again, and I haven't done.
Joe's career is very unusual because in the 1960s he was a really central figure in the development of British pop art. But in 1970 he upped sticks and left London and moved to the country and really turned his back on a lot of the issues that had absorbed him during the previous decade. My name is Marco Livingstone, and I am the author of the first full monograph to be published on Joe Tilson, and the book is called simply Joe Tilson. Joe and his wife Joss had had three children from the late 50s to the mid-60s, and I think they decided that living in the country in an old rectory was going to be a nicer place to bring up their children. When they moved there in 1970, so they were all preteen still at that age. But there was also a feeling of disenchantment with the art world and with London and with urban life generally. And so they were very involved with back-to-earth issues, with ecology, all the things that people talk about now. They were there over 50 years ago, growing some of their own food, planting trees, being close to the earth.
Must have been a big step because you were here in London enormous, producing work, yeah. About, you know, dealing with pop art consumerism, and then you literally left it all behind.
And a complete flip, yeah. Because, I mean, when I first, I think I was so naive and brought up totally, as you can see, if you start work at the age of 14 in London, you are densely and intimately connected with the London scene and urban life, not the country. I mean, the idea that grass grew didn't occur to me. I didn't realise you had to cut it. And therefore, I was that stupid. I mean, it's amazing, leap from total ignorance to total involvement, thanks to Joss, because Joss obviously really grew everything.
But it was a literal leap of faith into deeper connection with the earth.
We were saved, yeah. Thank God.
And what was the impact on your work? Because it was quite profound.
Absolutely. Well, the evidence is in the work. Yes, you then see from the political things, you then see the beginning of art connected to the earth, yes, and to ecology.
Up till that point, pretty much everything he did was in the form of screen printing, which, as I said, was the natural vehicle for the kind of images that those artists were making. Having moved to the countryside, he became more interested in sort of time-honoured materials. He'd been trained as a carpenter, and it was natural for him to go back to using wood. And in doing so, other printing media became more important, particularly etching, where you're making a mark, you're incising into the substrate. So you've got a direct contact with earthy materials, if you like. I mean, he's a very tactile artist. He's very engaged with the materials, and so etching in various forms lent itself more to his practice from 1970 onwards. There's a very interesting portfolio, which is hardly known at all, called Fragments of an Homeric Alphabet, which he started when he was in London and completed when he was in the country. And it contains a mixture of political pop art and several hints as to what the future would bring. So, you know, it relates to also to the four seasons, to myth, to memory. And it's all in one portfolio. And even in that portfolio, he broke all the rules because he printed on both sides of sheets of paper. So that they're almost impossible to exhibit. But that wouldn't have bothered him at all.
In a sense, he doesn't care about fashion. That's almost incidental to everything that he does. And probably as he's got older, cares even less about it. And there's something great that if it's not fashionable, it's never going to be totally unfashionable. So in that sense, they just go on and on.
Kit Kemp is the creative director of Ferndale Hotels and the Kit Kemp Design Studio in London and New York. She owns a number of works by Jo.
At the last Royal Academy summer exhibition, I bought two of his works. So I'm a long-time believer. I do always love his love of nature. And so very often, if there's that sort of leaf, seed pod, that fecundity of life that comes across, I very much like those pieces. But also, I do like his games and puzzles, which are put together within boxes, within sort of areas that can either be almost like a pyramid or a square or an oblong, and sometimes just the playfulness of them. He loves the sort of symbolism, the mythology, the matrix, the labyrinths and puzzles of life. And that comes across in his work.
The paintings, sculptures and prints that fill Jo's studio are often textured and handcrafted. Propped up against an easel is a print called Earth, Earth from 1980, which combines etching, aquatint and carborundum.
Yeah, no, that's quite beautiful.
Can you describe it for us?
Yeah, well, this is a series of things. Like, all the work I do is never one thing or another. It's never just about printing or just about wood reliefs. That is, in fact, a wood relief which I made, which is surrounded by more wood. And then they had burn brands. I decided to make marks through fire. So I had a lot of burn brands made and did a wooden reliefs. And burnt the letters into the wooden relief. And that print is done from that, using carborundum.
So it's a kind of harlequin pattern of blocks, but each one has a letter from the word earth in it. So
and the words is very curious, because when you repeat the words, other words appear, like ear, hear, earth, and so on. Do you see when
heart.
You read them? Heart, yeah, exactly. So it's partially like a puzzle.
The print features a hexagonal frame in burnt sienna, within which sit dozens of tightly packed brown lozenge shapes, each stamped with one of five letters, E, A, R, T, H. The word earth repeats across the surface, and the colours and textures make it feel as if the print is made from the earth itself.
I think why it works so well is, funny enough, there's a little throwback here to pop art in the form of serial imagery, at the same time as it being a kind of mantra. So it's the repetition of words. It's almost like an incantation.
But interestingly, at the time when you moved to the countryside, 1970, you started your first notebook. Could we have a look at the first notebook that you
Absolutely.
Did? And can you describe why you started to keep them?
Dozens of them are here in the studio, piled up on the table in front of us.
Well, I suppose it's a literary thing.
Leafs through one of the notebooks as we speak.
There we are, living in Argyle Road, Kensington.
So your name and address stenciled on the front, a bit like Picasso or Braque might have letters.
No, I've always used print processes. Yeah. Oh, and there's a wonderful Eros, Narcissus and Orpheus, and opposite Thanatos, Prometheus and Heracles crossed out and the right direction taken. But it's interesting to see the things that you come across, like the cube, which is the Greek sign for the earth.
These notebooks offer a fascinating insight into his work, packed full of drawings and writings about literature and philosophy that he constantly calls upon. They're part visual diary and part memory bank.
And looking at just that first page where you had the Greek names and the and myth coming into it, this is a big departure from that London work.
Totally,
that suddenly you are back in a world of myth and deep time, and you're, and the pages, they're kind of a bit bigger than A4, and they're just covered in drawings and quotes.
Absolutely.
What's interesting, looking through your notebooks too, is how much you have symbols or even on this page we have the kind of a spiral and a labyrinth. All these, in your very first notebook, these are ideas you still investigate today. The ziggurat.
But I think there are things also that go back in time for centuries and centuries. They are really re-establishing the meaning of certain symbols that reoccur. And therefore, I'm part of a tradition. It's the European tradition that brings into it all the things from outside.
Do you think that's what it is? It's a kind of way of us trying to map the world?
Oh, yes. It's a pathetic attempt to try to understand everything.
Through his words and those of historians and poets, as well as his annotations on alchemy, ziggurats and numerology, his notebooks chronicle the power of the artist to make sense of our complex world.
I think he feels that myth informs our education just as much as supposed recorded historical fact, and that he is very much part of that tradition. He likes the idea of being part of that tradition. I mean, the 20th, 21st centuries have their myths also, but it's understanding his place in this cultural continuum, and also the belief that, you know, myth, wherever it comes from, is grounded in fact, and so myths can be just as important and probably even less deceptive than recorded history.
Myths span time and place and connect us directly to the natural world and our place within it. Metamorphosis of Daphne, an etching with aquitaine from 1987, embodies this.
I'm particularly interested in hearing your thoughts about your Metamorphosis of Daphne, because I first knew about that through the print. But actually, when I looked into it, you've done a wood relief, you've done a terracotta sculpture, a painting. Well, how do ideas germinate for you?
It's my love of Ovid is from the Metamorphoses, and therefore Ovid, who I came across and have read and reread a lot, and then came across all the works done in Italy particularly, where Ovid was taken very seriously and the Metamorphoses are endlessly used by Italian artists. So I'm part of that tradition. That's really Italian art.
Because it's a giant print. It's too big for us to get out today.
Yeah.
It's over a metre square.
Yeah. It's a lovely print.
But it looks like a giant bush.
Yeah.
With two kind of trunks until you realise the trunks are her hands. Daphne turning into a tree to escape Apollo's advances.
Against a spare green ground, two trunk-like arms reach up, their fingers spreading into thick leafy branches. Vivid red Greek letters spelling Daphne's name fan out around the base. The print is both a personification of the myth and a consideration of the role of myth-making in our society.
What's wonderful in art, I think, is that you do something and you know it and you think no one knows it, but out there are people who understand it, who then come to it and give it the meaning which lies within them anyway.
So you impart it, but you're hoping...
Yes, the work embodies it. You are part of the myth. Part of myth-making from the Greeks to us includes Ovid. Now it includes me, but it includes you as an interpreter. So it includes all of us. And it won't go away. It remains.
In the 60s, he was a kind of public figure. I don't think he wanted that. And in his mid-90s, he still doesn't want that. You know, if you talk to him about the subject matter of his prints or his constructions or what have you, he'll always somehow deflect away from his practice and insist that the meaning of the work will only come through, you know, it's completed by the viewer. And he can't expect the viewer always to understand what he privately is getting at. So he'll always shy away from attention.
A lot of the emotional impact of Tilson's printmaking and painting alike for me comes from the physicality of his use of the mediums. They're very tactile, very sensuous, very seductive. His use of colour is very intuitive. There's a lot of feeling of nature in the work, but filtered through these signs of nature. So not a conventional way of representing a tree, for example, but a kind of emblem of treeness, if you like. And I think what holds one's attention in them, if you have them hanging on your wall, is they're not just flat designs. They're every mark really counts, and they hold your attention because you're always noticing different things in them and different depths and just the movement of his hand, because they're very handmade prints. Unlike the work he was making in the 60s using photo screen printing techniques, for example, where he was using material that he found in the world, you know, in magazines and photographs. Now he's inventing everything, and it's all shaped by his touch. And you really feel the communication from artist to viewer through his hands.
I find that you can't absorb everything in one viewing of Joe Tilson's work. It requires a second, third, and fourth look. Kit Kemp uses the complexity of Joe's work to engage with guests at the Whitby Hotel in New York.
What I love about Joe's work is that I can be playful with it. So I've actually put one of his very large pieces. It's about sort of 2 meters by 2 meters, and it comes out from the wall and it's very colourful. You feel like it's a sort of a game or a puzzle, but I haven't put it on a plain background. Behind it, I've almost got this wonderful wallpaper called Tribe, which is actually of falling leaves by someone called Kate Blee. And it's actually on a staircase. So as you're going down the staircase, it's almost as if instead of going between two spaces, this is a space where you can actually stand and dream, and it transports you. So I love his work for that very reason, actually. You're sort of transported to somewhere else within his weird and wonderful world and mind.
As Kit says, there's an otherworldliness to Joe's work. He's very concerned with texture, with the feel of things, the deep grain of wood or the rough pigmentation of earth. His paintings and sculptures are multisensory, and to achieve this in his prints, he was the first British artist to use carborundum, a technique he was introduced to in 1979.
So carborundum is a very hard mineral which you can form into a paste onto an etching plate, and when it's printed, this lump goes through the press and it indents the paper. And in doing so, immediately gives a very tangible feel to the product. And he first learnt about it from an artist called Henry Gertz. But where he'd seen it most often was in the prints of Juan Miró, who used it extensively in the last 30 years of his life, creating very rich textured colour. And that felt right to Joe.
And so the Miro prints that have big, black, chunky bits that I loved are directly from Goetz. And Miro really understood exactly how to do it. And so he developed that. And after I spent some time with Henri, I came back to England and bought all the necessary carborundum, all the materials, and started doing prints, which are then printed in Milan.
So I love you have a book by him, but you also have your original notes of all the different measurements you need to make the inks.
These are the different types of carborundum.
Yeah, the very fine grey powder.
Because it's a powder, you see. You put the powder on. Oh, there's a one here. Oh, here it is.
Oh, so we actually have a printing plate here.
That is the printing plate.
So it's a metal plate.
Yeah, it's a metal plate on which you put this carborundum mixed with something that can hold it. And then you ink it up, and then you put it in a press, and you take the paper printed from that. And that could be any colour you want. You see, that's the material, but that could be black, or it could be bright yellow, or red, or green.
But what's really unusual about this as a printing technique, looking at the plate now, is that it's like looking at impastoed paint.
Yeah,
it's absolutely thick and chunky.
Yes, I mean, that's, you see, in a way, I mean, I developed it a bit and did a few prints, but when my friend Howard Hodgkin, I showed the technique that I got from Henri to my printer, Jack Sheriff, but then later on, Hodgkin went to work with Jack Sheriff to do his prints, and Jack showed him this technique. So Howard Hodgkin's prints are all taken from this idea of using it. And as you see, it relates strongly to brushwork, doesn't it? You see all those things in the brushwork.
It's a thick painted line, chunky painted line.
An amazing technique.
It gives this great impression of physicality. And I think that's particularly important for Joe, who enjoys the feel of wood. He enjoys making a mark, branding things, burning things. And it feels like a kind of very natural, earthy method.
Joe had been taught the carborundum technique in Milan. He has had a lifelong love affair with Italy ever since he travelled to Rome in 1955 after winning the Royal College of Arts Rome Prize. It was in Rome that he met his future wife, the artist Jocelyn Morton. They were married in Venice the following year. In the 1970s, they bought an old farmhouse in Tuscany where they lived and worked for a few months each year. Today, Joe shows me a screen print from the series Lucrete Senisi, named after the hills around Siena. The hilltops have eroded into chalk white cones, a motif that recurs throughout the prints. In the one we look at, a small triangular shape sits on a surface printed from wood to show the grain.
And you've done paintings and prints of these.
Yes, a lot.
Now, the prints I find particularly interesting because, again, what you said before, you don't do printmaking in a way that we'd say a traditional way, because here you've spliced two really different printmaking techniques together.
Oh, yeah, because I cut out great big sheets of wood, long trunks all sliced up, and put that at the bottom, and then painted, stretched canvas, and then painted it, cut a hole in the middle, and then made a series of reliefs. So there are the reliefs and also the prints like this that come from that series.
When I look at the print, it's almost like the earth of Italy is appearing in front of me. It's just an array of different browns, which you've pointed out before, burnt umber, but also burnt sienna.
Sienna.
Raw sienna.
And what's the word? Sienna. And umbro is Umbria, which is the next bit of Italy where we live.
So the very shape of the print, it's a kind of arch shape. Inside there's a triangular shape, which is like the little cones that appear on top of the hills.
Yes, the Biancane, yes.
But then the sense of the wood layers along the bottom and the splatters of paint like earth, it's almost like you've created something that looks like the shape of the mountain, but also is the mountain, is the very earth it's made from.
Yeah, I know. I'm delighted with your response to it, because that's exactly what's intended.
He's hinting at the shapes of the hills. The combination of all these different earthy colours have a great satisfaction. You feel not only the beauty of them, but also the sensation of them. I mean, it is a beautiful landscape, and he manages to evoke that in an abstracted form.
In 2002, Joe and Joss bought a small house in Venice. This marked a new shift in Joe's work as he began to look closely at the facades of Venetian churches and study the intricate floor patterns he found within them.
And he started marrying those together in diptychs, both in paintings and in prints. He used the title The Stones of Venice, which he borrowed from John Ruskin's book. It was really a very personal response to a city with which he felt such strong affinity.
The prints are a heady mix of processes, including carborundum, screen printing and hand colouring. Bright cobalt blue skies frame campaniles and tracery windows, while reds, yellows and blacks pick out the patterns of the tessellated church floors, now transformed into abstract panels.
Today we're surrounded by paintings that relate to this series. I can even see the campanile of St. Mark's coming out your head behind you.
Yeah. It was a wonderful place.
There's sort of mnemonic devices or aide-mémoire to that feeling of being in Venice and being confronted by the architecture and just contemplating the floors, which are extraordinary abstract patterns in their own right. They're among the most decorative of his works, and it's a dirty word in the art world still for a lot of people, but not for me. So I enjoy their decorative quality. Their use of colour, their use of pattern, and they really buzz. You know, there's a lot in them to hold your attention and to give pleasure.
I think they're the most joyful of Joe's images because he has such admiration for the architecture of Venice. And that joy kind of bursts through. It's like he's reinvigorating works of the past, and for most of the time in glorious colour. The kind of colour that was there when these churches or the mosaics were first made. And they're still as relevant today as they were all that time ago. So they're not nostalgic in any way.
I've recently come back from Venice. So in your honour, I took some photographs of some floors to show you. I'm sure you'll recognise where they're from, but it's a test. To see if you know which floor I photographed. Let's have a look. Hang on. I put them on Instagram. And let me see if I can find them. Here you go. I'm not letting you see the word. Where is that floor from?
Oh, I've no idea. The funniest thing is I've just seen a photograph of Vladimir Putin standing, and below him they've used this layout.
Like a trompe l'oeil floor. Yeah. Oh, well, this one's in the Ducal Palace, so I think this is nicer than a Putin floor. So, yeah, I just took a few little pictures of the floors because you made me see differently, and that's what great artists do.
Yes, I must say, going around Venice, everybody looks up, whereas a good thing is to look down, and then you see that. It's
just a beautiful floor, wonderful. All in the Palazzo Ducale. But I love the fact that in this series, The Stones of Venice, you have the facades of buildings on one side and then you have a detail of what looks like a floor, tesserated floor. And again, it's that sense of the whole building and then the tiny detail, a micro or macro. This
and also not only that building, but the civilization, which then includes the civilization of the East because it's very influenced by Oriental art and deeply part of the culture that spans the whole of Europe and includes all those people as far as India, which is very important, I think, you know.
Venice has always had that amazing
place,
hasn't it? The East and West.
Together, yeah, which continues. I mean, I do believe strongly in everybody coming together.
So this is a hard question. Which is your favourite type of printmaking? Can you even answer that?
The favourite type of printmaking is the printmaking I'm doing at the moment. Always has been.
Joe Tilson has been ahead of the game his whole life. He left pop art behind to explore a deeper connection with the earth, the elements, history and myth. In his first notebook from 1970, he wrote, "We must understand our own nature more deeply and our own place in the total environment of the planet Earth." He continues to explore this in his prints, paintings and sculptures.
This is my last question to you. Tomorrow is your 94th birthday.
Oh, don't remind
Will you me. Be working on your birthday or does Joss make you have a day off?
Joss is good, yeah. Joss will feed me well and the children.
You might get a day out of this lovely studio.
Yeah.
If there is a legacy, I think it's in the understanding that we are a part of history in an age when history is completely neglected. He's a peacemaker and a rebel at the same time, but he leaves a joyful legacy through the sheer energy of his work.
You've been listening to Making a Mark from the Christea Roberts Gallery, presented by Charlotte Mullins. To find out more about Jo Tilson and the work we've been discussing, please visit www.christearoberts.com.